We get on board the telephone line and welcome in our friend David Roth of Defector, the co-host of the Distraction Podcast. Mr. Roth, good afternoon, sir.
Hey, Rich. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
Pretty good. You can sort of see the end of the week from here. It's nice.
Well, yeah, and you're getting ready for a little vacation, too.
I am, yeah. We're finally getting back to Maine for the actual vacation part of it, as opposed to the carrying large boxes of old hardback books for my father-in-law part of it, which we did earlier in the summer. So I'm looking forward to that very much. Like, this is going to be the one where we actually try to unplug a little bit.
Well, that's good. Well, I'm glad to get to do that. Well, we wanted to catch up with you before vacation began. And while things are still fresh in your mind here, let's start with a little baseball. Your Mets are hanging in there, although it's getting a little tight right now.
Yeah, I've been working on being normal about the Mets. I've been working on that my whole life. But this year in particular has been kind of a challenge. They are good. I'm going to go ahead and just put that out there. I feel okay saying that. But yeah, the Braves have been winning 72% of their games since July 1st, which is one of those things that tends to tighten up a divisional race. I'm just trying to enjoy the fact that this is a good Mets team, and that they're in every game and every game's worth watching. And, you know, after a few years of, you know, just finding myself being drawn more and more to watching like an episode of Guy's Grocery Games instead of the Mets, it's nice to have them be a team that I want to watch for nine innings. I'm trying to leave it at that. But yeah, the Braves are making me nervous, man. They are very good. And, you know, but whatever. If your team is roughly as good as the defending world champions, you're probably still okay.
I've been watching the Red Sox, but now that you mention it, Guy's Grocery Game seems like I would find it much more fulfilling than watching this team that's got a huge payroll and playing in a big market send out guys you probably will never hear of again to pitch in relief or to play positions that they never played in their life.
I think I know who you're talking about on that last one, and I made a little note to myself, you have to go watch Bobby Dalbec play shortstop. That was happening yesterday, and I missed it. I just got distracted with other stuff in my life, and I feel like I missed a really good opportunity to watch a guy who is shaped the same way that all the characters were in RBI Baseball for the original Nintendo hold down the keystone for the damn Red Sox in an actual Major League Baseball game that counted. I don't know what I have.
He wasn't horrible there, but he, you know, he hits like it looks like I do. You know, for a while, I don't think we don't have it in town anymore. But we used to have, you know, an old batting cage at a mini golf place here in town, and once a year I would go over and pour quarters into the high speed pitching machine, and I would flail away and feel good when I fouled a couple off, and that's what Bobby Dalbec looks like to me every time he's at the plate, particularly with men on base.
Yeah, so I have a coworker who's from New Hampshire and is a big Red Sox fan, and he personally has, I guess you would call it a vendetta against Bobby Dalbec, and I feel bad because it seems like he's the sort of guy that gets blamed. Like, he shouldn't be the most important guy or the guy you think of when you think of a team. That wasn't what they drafted and developed him to be. There's enough other problems there, you know, that it's all going to kind of run downhill on the poor Bobby. But I talked to my sort of scoutier friends, like people that actually follow this stuff more closely, because I was fascinated by him in, I think it was, maybe it was last year's spring training, where he was the best hitter in the world for 2 weeks of games that don't count. And they were like, yeah, he's a really interesting type of player, but not in a way that you want, that he has like authentic 80 power, that he is like has as much lightning in his bat as anybody that's playing the game. He just has 80 power on the 20 to 80 scouting scale, and then maybe a 30 hit tool. So it's the sort of thing where he can, in theory, hit any pitch further than anybody else in the sport, but also more than half the time he's going to go up there holding the wrong end of the bat.
Yes.
And that's just a really difficult type of player to build a team around, which, I mean, I know they're not, but it's like, you know, if you have enough of those guys on your team, sooner or later you start to notice it.
But they decided to complement him by bringing in his left-handed doppelganger, Franchi Cordero, who also, when he does make contact, it'll go 450, but that only happens about once every 87 swings.
Yeah. like when teams are not doing well, the Pirates do this a lot too, which is not the comparison that you want, where you have a guy that like maybe theoretically could help you on offense. He's bad at a low value defensive position. And then you just start getting him reps at another low value defensive position just to see what happens. You're not in a good place when you're doing that. So like the Pirates like to do that with their, like their banjo hitting middle infielders. And they're like, I wonder if he can play left.
Right.
And that's not, you don't put Kevin Newman in left. Like, you don't even need to put him at short. You just need to, you know, like, try to find a guy who's better than Kevin Newman. But this is, I don't know. The Red Sox, in general, to me, seem like they're going through, you know, it, everything about this season has been cursed. You know, that, like, fluky Chris Sale injuries, like, a bunch of the team refusing to get vaccinated, and, like, you know, just sort of, that sends, I think, the wrong message. Like, it just tells me that the locker room is not cooking right. But also, they've done this before where they've had, you know, not just bad seasons, but miserable seasons. Seasons where you think that they're going to tear the whole thing down. And, like, you know, the one that they had under Bobby Valentine, they won the World Series the next year. I'm not saying that that's going to happen for them, you know, next year. I wouldn't bet on it. But I think that there is, they're not quite as betwixt and between as I think they look from one day to the next. But, yeah, there's obviously, I would have stopped watching at this point. I think like that was the one little gift I gave myself with the Mets last year was like, you know, if they're just making you feel bad, like there's so much other stuff on TV.
Right, like Guy's grocery games.
Right. Yeah. Which honestly is not the best of the Guy Fieri shows that's on. It just happens to be the one that's on the most.
Right. I mean, it's no Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives, but you, any port in a storm.
Right. I agree with that. Do you know the thing about Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives and the Mets owner?
No.
So Steve Cohen is obsessed with the show. And so before he had the Mets, when he was just a prolific financial criminal living in Connecticut, he apparently paid for Fieri to like just drive around like Bridgeport and Fairfield with him for a day, going to the hot dog places that he likes. Like he like hired, he booked Guy Fieri to do that.
Oh man.
And then they eventually, one of those places made it into the show. So there's like a, there's a, you know, Texas Wiener place in Bridgeport, which is a truly grim city, so it must be a good hot dog place, where Cohen is, like, on screen. I don't think that he talks or anything like that, but you can just see a kind of extremely wealthy-looking bald man happily eating a hot dog in the corner over Fieri's shoulder.
All right, I have to go watch reruns just to see if I can
yeah, it's
spot
like,
that.
It's kind of like when people point out that like you can find Bruce Willis in the courtroom scenes in The Verdict as a as an expert or something. It's just the opposite of like, I mean, I guess they're both successful bald men, but I think of Willis as being more charismatic of the two.
Somewhat, yeah, absolutely. David Roth with us here on Downtown. I enjoyed your piece on Justin Verlander's pursuit of yet another, as you put it, dumb round number.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, anything to do with pitcher wins is necessarily pretty dumb. I mean, there's just a lot of ways, you know, whatever. Rick Porcello wins 22 games in a season, and you just sort of look at that, and you're like, all right, well, like, that's probably a bad stat then, right? And it is a bad stat. There's too much, you know, of, like, sort of randomness folded into it. There's so many ways that, you know, you can throw seven shutout innings and not win a game, or you can allow six runs in five innings and win it. Verlander, you know, has, I think, the best shot of getting to 300, certainly of anyone who's active. He's got 242 wins now and is still the best pitcher in baseball at the age of 39. But, you know, there's no, I was sort of fascinated by that, you know, the possibility of someone getting there because there are fewer wins being shared around. Like, of the elite veteran pitchers in the game, that Verlander's the only one, except for Zach Greinke, that even has 200 wins, that Kershaw and Max Scherzer are still under that. But when I was looking at the guys that had gotten to 300 wins in the last, you know, I guess 12, 15 years, it's the pitchers you'd expect. You know, it's Greg Maddux and Randy Johnson and, you know, Tom Glavine. And yet none of them got there in a very dignified way. It's just, it's really hard, even if you are, you know, authentically Cooperstown bound, like long lived ace. At some point, like you find yourself winning your 300th game, like Randy Johnson did, wearing a Giants uniform, which is like just something that nobody would ever remember about his career. And I'm wondering where Verlander sort of fits into that because he's, you know, as great as he's been this year, and I think he'll win 20 games this year, that still leaves him, you know, with 55 more wins to get. And, you know, if he wants to hang around to do that, like, there is definitely the possibility that he wins that 300th game, you know, as a junk baller fifth starter for the Brewers in 2028.
And it's kind of an old tradition. I was looking at the stats for Early Wynn, who came back at the age of 43 with the 1963 Cleveland team and went 1-2, which meant I just hanging around long enough to get that 300th win.
Yeah, there's the very few. I mean, the only player in recent memory that got there while they were still dominant was Roger Clemens.
Right.
And that's like the one that we just don't talk about, because even by the time he won it, everybody was kind of like, oh, this guy. And then, you know, he hung around. He's finished with 350 odd wins for his career. I mean, Clemens didn't slow down until the only really remotely average season of his career, he was 44. This is his last one. And yet, like, you know, I think Clemens being the exception that proves the rule here is, like, you know, the reason that everybody dislikes him is that not just that he's a turd, but that he was on that gear. And in this case, like, I mean, if that's what it takes to get there and still be striking people out and scaring everybody, like, it's much likelier that you get there the Early Wynn way, which is just by kind of accepting that you're going to have to abase yourself a little bit in pursuit of, you know, that number that has two zeros at the end of it.
David, is there anything that better epitomizes the absolute greed of professional sports than this battle between the PGA Tour and the LIV Tour?
I'm fascinated by it. I'm mostly because I think, you know, I don't understand what the Saudis' angle is with the LIV Tour. Like, if you told me that it was all some sort of back channel way to funnel money to Donald Trump, I'd be like, yeah, sure. Like, that makes as much sense
right.
as blowing a few hundred million dollars on a golf tour that's just like the best golfers of 2014 going out there and playing in front of nobody. You know, like, but what's fascinating about it to me, and Chris Thompson has written about this a bunch for The Defector, and it has really, like, gotten, I think, a good handle and perspective on it, is that the PGA Tour being under pressure is a very funny thing on the merits, because of all the big sports organizations, they have to be the most complacent.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's just very staid country club thought, and then suddenly they're getting this pressure, and they're just like, no bad ideas. Let's do it. What are we going to do? All right, Rory McIlroy is wearing a tank top. Great. Terrific. All right, can Tiger Woods juggle? Like, and they're just, like, it's panic mode, and yet, like, some of the stuff that they've come up with has been, you know, the sort of bad idea that you can only have when you're truly scared.
And I think that brings out the best in people, as we've seen so often. All right, I have to ask you about the legal battles of the former president of the United States. Interesting legal team that he's assembled of late. I believe it's made up primarily of women who did not get their job they hoped for as Fox anchors.
Yeah, it's people that are on-air talent at the One America News Network. There's a story that some of my attorney friends sent me earlier that he apparently, we should clarify, we're talking about Donald Trump. He's the guy that's in trouble.
Right.
I know
yes.
It could be any ex-president getting investigated in six different states for multiple crimes. But in this case, the one we're talking about is the guy that was president just before, like a few years ago. So you got on-air talent from One America News Network, and then apparently he has took some advice from the head of the organization Judicial Watch, a guy named Tom Fitton.
Oh, yeah.
You might, he's a big, like, just like kind of a bodybuilder with a haircut. And he took control of that organization from an actual crazy lawyer named Larry Klayman. Tom Fitton is not a lawyer. Tom Fitton has a BA. He has the same degree that I do, the guy that writes about baseball and gets sad. And he is not like so he was apparently the guy that told Trump they don't have any, the National Archives has no right to these things, they're yours, you should keep them. And he was like, oh great, like the idea that Trump ran out of lawyers who would tell him what he wanted and just was like, find me a non-lawyer, the biggest one you can. Like, he needs to be, I need him strong. And then they got Tom Fitton to go in there and just be like, yeah, actually, like, if you want it, that's the law. And so that sort of helped get him in this place. I don't think that there's, I feel like if I were an attorney I completely understand why you would want nothing to do with Trump, not just beyond a personal distaste for him, that everyone that he hires, he calls a traitor on social media within 18 months of meeting them.
Right.
It's just bad. It's bad business. Like, just let that be somebody else's problem, you know?
But I ask you this because, again, you seem to have an understanding of how that mind of his works. He has to know it's not going well for him lately.
I think that he is, I mean, again, like, he's always kind of in this state of, it's a flow state. Like, he's just going, but he is also panicked. I mean, I think at this point he has been outrunning accountability for his entire life and, you know, successfully at that. But, I just don't think that there's a plan here. I think that there's certainly not, you know, a legal strategy that works. And so this is sort of, I think that for him, and I think also for a lot of the people who have, you know, their whole sort of self and worldview invested in the idea of him being, you know, absolutely impervious to accountability for the entire rest of his life, that, like, that if they think that, like, if he is held to account, then they will be too. Like, in that case, like, you can see why this matters so much and why he's screeching about it in such a strange and anxious way, even by his standards. And yet, it all seemed very easy to avoid. That, like, he invited this by being weird, and now he's trying to get out of it by continuing to be weird. And I think at some point, you know, this is always where Trump tends to run aground, is that, like, he's not big on changing direction. I mean, that, like, he's just, he mashes the button that makes the treats come out, and that's how he's lived his entire life. And I don't really see any willingness to deviate from that, even as it just gets worse and worse and worse, and as all of the sort of, you know, the one-day strategies where it's like, they planted it, it's not real, it's okay that I have it, it's like, I declassified it, I was bringing my work home. But every one of those things that he pivots off of, like, is its own discrete bad excuse that is then abandoned and flushed away at the end of that day. There's still not a coherent explanation that I've seen for why he did this.
No.
And, you know, in the absence of that, I don't know how he's ever going to get out of it.
No, but I guess I've been frustrated so many times imagining there might be some kind of legal accountability. So I'm not holding my breath for that anytime soon. But I think the real accountability, and I guess it's the most, well, it's the most justified one, is that he's done it to himself, because I don't think, I could be wrong, he's done. He's done as a presidential candidate. He's done as anybody who can win. I don't even think he can get the nomination if he goes for it. And that's the ultimate insult. Worse than Donald Trump going to jail, I think, for him, or pretty close, is becoming politically irrelevant.
Yeah, it's like that, you know, the last scene of Goodfellas where Ray Liotta says, I got to live the rest of my life as a schnook.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's basically, I think that's the nightmare for a certain, especially for a guy like him. Like, he'll always be surrounded by supplicants, you know, like, he lives in a hotel or whatever the Mar-a-Lago is, and his whole day-to-day seems to be just, like, wandering into people's weddings that have, like, booked the event space and being like, have a great time, terrific, like, enjoy the shrimp. You know, and that's like what he wants. I mean, I think that's him in his element to a certain extent, is
right.
Being like the, there's a personality that my mom used to call Mr. Restaurant, like the person that shows up at a place and wants you to know that they know all the specials, they order off menu, and they're a big deal there. Like, he's a Mr. Restaurant type.
I can send back anything I want. They'll make it exactly
right, yeah.
The way I like it.
Right. I get a slightly bigger cake. Yeah. Slice than everybody else because they know me and they know I'm a good guy. And, like, to me, like, if that's what he wanted all along, and I think it is, then there's still this element, you know, it's sort of hard to laugh at because, like, we had to live in the country that he, you know, while he was in charge of it for 4 years. And even if, and I do think he's not in a strong position as a candidate now, he's still, I think, one of the most important people in our politics, just because that party doesn't, he's the only real candidate that Republicans actually care about. He's just also so unpopular that he's the only guy that could lose, you know, he could lose a popular election to Hillary Clinton. I mean, he won, you know, on the sort of fluky stuff. But, like, think about what that means. Like, he got trounced by Joe Biden, and all Joe Biden did that whole campaign was whisper into a Zoom window.
Right. And all he had to say was, people, gosh darn it, I'm not him. I'm not that guy.
Right. Seriously. Just being like, you think I'm kidding? I'm not. That's another guy, Jack. That worked. He won by 7 million votes. So it seems to me like if... I don't know, you know, where any of this goes. And obviously there's like this powerful cult of personality around him, and that's not going away.
No.
I think that there's still, you know, I saw it when I was at the Jersey Shore with my family last week. There's still a lot of people who, you know, will take one extra minute out of their vacation to run a Trump flag up a flagpole outside of their rental home. Like, it's their way of saying, I mean, I guess in some ways, like, no solicitors, please. But also, it's a statement of purpose. Like, he means a lot to them. It's just that he's, I think the mystique is gone, you know, that, like, so much of the whole idea of him and the way that he sort of talked about himself as if, you know, he was never in doubt, he was never wrong, he was always in control. That's, I mean, not just for, like, Q weirdos. That's the fantasy for all Trump followers. It's just like, you can't believe it now. There's no way that you can look at this guy chased from one courthouse to the next, taking the Fifth, with no evident plan and no real idea for how to get out of this beyond getting elected president again, and see that he's in control, because he's so clearly not.
David Roth, defector.com, the Distraction Podcast. As always, delightful talking with you, my friend. I hope your vacation is restful and relaxing, and you get all that Maine has to offer.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you very much. I feel like I just did.
All right. We'll talk to you soon, David.
All right, man. Take care. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Always. It's David Roth on Downtown.